Coming up on Boston Public Radio, yesterday the Supreme Court signed off on a Michigan voter ban on race as a factor in higher education admissions. We'll ask you if it's a right choice or a step back for racial equality. Then, federal agents shut down an illegal community radio station in Boston despite the pleas of Governor Patrick. The station's co-founder will tell us if there's a future for Touch 106.1. Then, Thoreau spent 2 years cataloging Mother Nature minutiae at Walden Pond. Now a BU professor is updating the work and telling us what a changing climate in Concord means for all of us.
Then, Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly's David Frank. Are judges permitted to make public statements? And if they are, why don't they? He'll also update us on the Tsarnaev trial and predict if we'll ever see cameras in federal courtrooms. And finally, Jared Bowen reviews current local stage and screen.
Welcome. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 FM. I am Jim Browdy. I believe Marjorie Egan is off communing with Hillary Clinton. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It's Simmons or something?
Think they can recognize my voice?
I think they can. And Emily Rooney is sitting in instead. How are you, Emily?
Good, Jim.
So call it bitter irony. We're marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act this year, as you know. And yesterday, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that states can disregard race as a factor in university admissions. The 6-2 ruling upheld the constitutionality of a measure passed by voter referendum in Michigan, which disallowed so-called affirmative action in college admissions. As Boston Globe columnist Derek Jackson put it, the tyranny of the majority won. Access to college for African Americans and Latinos suffered another major defeat. Instead of surveying the destruction of opportunity that is occurring at this very hour, the Supreme Court cowered behind a purist reading of the Constitution. Derek Jackson joins us on the line from his office at the Boston Globe. Derek, how are you?
Hi, Jim and Emily. Hey, I'm doing fine.
Derek, great. We certainly have no idea where you stand on this issue. My goodness. Coward. So seriously, how does this limit access to college for African Americans and Latinos? There's still a box that's optional that you can check that's, you know, everything, you know, religion, race, all of that. People do check in. And also, let's face it, college admission people are looking for minorities. They're looking for Latinos. They're looking for people to make a diversified student body. Why does this limit access?
Well, first of all, even without this, it's still been a struggle. The New York Times has a terrific graph that virtually no university in America is yet at the percentage of black college-age students in their particular population. And the fact of the matter is that this is a major decision because, you know, for instance, a legacy student has many options, as both the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals said, and it's also Sonia Sotomayor said yesterday, that students who want to take advantage of legacy admissions can lobby the admissions committee, university leadership, even the school's governing board to use their parents' alumni status. But a black student who wishes to, you know, could have race considered. And we need to remember that race is not just sort of this sort of arbitrary thing. Race in this context, historical context, affirmative action is meant to remedy historical discrimination and disadvantage. And one of the things that is conveniently ignored by the opponents of affirmative action is that many, not all, of course, but many white families have had an unbroken string, legacy string of access, not to mention other issues such as, their rising incomes over decades and that sort of thing. So there are a ridiculous amount of advantages that other groups have had, and affirmative action, which only was around, has been around since in the late 20th century, to remedy decades of discrimination, it's still a very, very ideally critical tool.
Derek Jackson from the Boston Globe. There are a bunch of states that have banned race as a factor in admissions. What's been the impact on student enrollment in those states? Do you know?
Fairly disastrous, in particularly in California. After the inaction, at one point in the 1990s, Hispanic enrollment, for instance, was at 23% at UCal Berkeley, and the population, the Hispanic age population for college was about 35%, a gap. But today, after affirmative action, only 11% of freshmen at Berkeley are Hispanic, compared to the fact that now that nearly 50% of the state's college-age residents are Hispanic. The black population, while smaller, has plummeted dramatically. In fact, in the late 90s, the black population at Cal Berkeley was the same as the state college-age residents who are black, which is about 9%. Today, 2% of the freshmen at Berkeley are black.
Derek, what does that tell you? Because colleges aren't intentionally discriminating against blacks and Latinos. What does it tell you?
No,
does
actually,
it say, they're not saying, this is a black guy, we don't want him. Or are they saying, you know what, he's not measuring up. The scores aren't high enough. The SAT scores, the grade scores, and we don't have to accept him anymore.
It's an interesting point, Emily. Two things on that. One is that in most of these cases, the universities opposed these bans. California didn't want it. Michigan certainly didn't want it. The former President Lee Bollinger, who's now at Columbia, didn't want it. They were, in fact, Bollinger was a defendant in the Michigan case in 2003.
Which is what, by the way, we should say, for those who don't know, was that 2003 case which upheld the use of race as one of a bunch of factors at the law school there. It was that case that led to this ballot initiative in 2006 in Michigan. But go ahead.
Yeah, I think the issue about unqualified is a red herring, Emily. It's for a couple reasons. Actually, in recent years, black high school graduates have graduated from high school at the same percentage of, in a couple of years, even a slightly higher rate than even white college, white high school students. It's quite evident with any rendering of research, such as what Derek Bach used to do, that the legacy, the kids walk in with legacy, whether or not their grades were great or mediocre. And I think we know a few presidents and presidential candidates who don't mind.
I know some rejectees, too.
Yeah. As my dad said, let me just on a point.
Sure.
As my dad once said, straight A's don't mean a thing if you don't have common sense.
Derek Jackson, one last thing from me. You're a former Cambridge public school parent, as am I.
Yeah.
And in the early 2000s, I hope I get this right, and I know you'll correct me if I don't, what Cambridge did was changed its issue for intra-city school choice, where originally race was a very high factor. It was reduced in importance, and what took its place was income, class issues. And not took its place, but it was elevated to a higher level. As you read the New York Times today, a lot of college admissions officers and presidents are scrambling for an alternative in the wake of this decision. They're saying that income is sort of a backdoor way to get close to what their goal was with when race was able to be a factor prior to yesterday in these public schools. What's wrong with that as a maybe not perfect, but as a backup position, so that upper middle class black kid might not get in, but a poor white kid who's had very little educational opportunity will get in?
At best, Jim, it would only move the needle of the disparity gap only very, very slightly. White Americans at every income level still numerically dominate. So even though you could say, well, African Americans and Latinos are disproportionately poor, still, the vast majority of the poor are still white. So that even an income-based system will still guarantee a majority white entrance population.
Hey, Derek Jackson, last thing from me, and thank you for your time. Is this just one more, whatever it is, one more step towards the across-the-board elimination of affirmative action in all contexts, workplaces? Is the court ultimately going to get to those places?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it's certainly a step in the wrong direction of a nation that needs to embrace diversity and understand its history. I mean, this is yet again another example of the Roberts Court, conveniently ignoring this nation's history and how we got to the place we have today. So it's too bad, and colleges are going to have to try to be as creative as they can, but certainly I think this decision, while not technically, as the Roberts Court and Anthony Kennedy try to claim, that it's not about the merits of affirmative action itself. The fact that this gives license for states which have vastly majority white populations, which most do, it gives them free rein to enact bans, even though, and that's why I wrote the tyranny in the majority, because those majorities failed to take in advance into account the history that brought us to the disparities we have today.
Good thing you live in Massachusetts, because we're never going to vote a ban in here, so don't worry about it.
And by the way, Derek, you also cited, I think it was you that cited the voting statistics as part of your tyranny of the majority notion. 58% of whites voted for this, 64% of white men, and 9-1 people of color voted against it. Hey, Derek Jackson, Boston Globe, we thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've got a link to his column on our website, wgbhnews.org/BPR. We want to take your calls on this now at 877-301-8970. Is this ruling one giant step back and leveling a skewed playing field, as Derek Jackson just suggested? Or do you think it's time we do away with race as a factor in this and other facets of decision-making in affirmative life and American life? And by the way, if you were someone who benefited from affirmative action, Marjorie would say she did. Mm-hmm. Were she here? She said she wouldn't have had her column did it not exist in workplaces where she was applying. She wouldn't have been what she is today. What's your take on this? 877-301-8970. You know what's interesting we didn't get to with Derek Jackson? While you expect in cases like this a 5-4 majority one way or another, it was 6-2. Now, Elena Kagan recused herself because she may have had some involvement when she was Solicitor General. Interestingly, Cambridge's own Steve Breyer, a reliable liberal vote on the court, voted with a majority, mm-hmm. saying essentially what Derek Jackson says, it's not about affirmative action, but voters'
rights
in that court.
Whether the voters have a right to vote these bans in or out.
But he's essentially saying that, at least if you listen to Sonia Sotomayor, who said, quote, it is a sentiment out of touch with reality, that Breyer, she would say, I think, mm-hmm. that Breyer is saying voters have a right to discriminate,
yes.
even if it violates
the
Equal
tough.
Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Yeah, she was really, and they said it was very rare, the kind of dissent position she took. She did a verbal portion of it as well as the written dissent, and was quite critical of it. I don't know. Where do you stand on this, Jim?
My view is there still is a need. And I have to say, I'm not where Derek Jackson is in response to your question. Mm-hmm. I think there's clearly still an achievement gap. Deval Patrick talks about it all the time. And as long as schools for people of color and for poor kids, some of whom are not people of color, are substandard as compared to the schools that a ton of white Americans are able to go to, then I think there's a need for this. And by the way, it's not the only factor. Let's be clear here. It is a factor. The Supreme Court got it right, in my opinion, in 2003. It may be one of many factors when you're deciding admission to a public university.
See, I really didn't understand the answer to the question I asked about why would colleges and universities who, in states that have enacted this ban, mm-hmm. why would they accept fewer blacks and Latinos, they know darn well from the college applications. It's obvious. Everything is transparent
now.
A lot of these people go for in-person interviews, so they know what who they're interviewing.
Well, the in-person interview is almost a thing of the past. But I agree with you. In terms of the application, you can probably tell
you
chose.
You're checking things off. Yeah. You know who they are. So I don't understand why they would accept fewer, unless they just feel like the pressure's off. Because all these colleges want to get a higher ranking. They want to have
higher graduation rates.
Higher, SAT score average and that whole
they
thing.
They also want wealthier alums, by the way,
true.
Whether public or private schools. 877-301-8970. Supreme Court decision came down yesterday, 6-2, as Emily said a minute ago, blistering dissent from Justice Sotomayor. And by the way, it was so blistering, she basically took on Roberts and some of the others, that Roberts actually responded to it, which they never did. In what he
Love
had
it.
To say. So do I,
Wish
by the
we'd
way.
Had a camera in that.
I'm so we're going to talk to David Frank about that in terms of federal courts in a little while.
Well, there is streaming in the court, in the United
yeah,
States
but
Supreme Court
don't
now.
Start
I
with that. I mean,
ridiculous.
You want to see their bodies. You want to see their body language. You want to see what they have to say.
Spitting the words out.
That is exactly the case. 877-301-8970. Has the President of the United States commented on this decision, as far as you know, Emily Rooney?
I haven't seen it, but...
And,
he was out of the country yesterday.
He was. He's in Asia. The odd part of this, I should say, is it's the very same Supreme Court, again, that decided in 2003, only 11 years ago, that at Michigan Law School, the very same state, which was the predicate for them mm-hmm. going to the people going to the ballot, that race could be a factor. And I don't understand, and I haven't read the opinion, I've just read stories about it. I don't understand the Breyer position, that it's not about affirmative action, about voter rights. So is the assumption that voters have a right to discriminate in any fashion they want?
Because voters in many states would vote against gay marriage. They would vote against interracial marriage. Do we want voters making those kinds of decisions?
Well, and by the way, the highest courts in some of those states have said voters don't have a right to do that. In any case, we're going to get to your calls in a second. We had apparently a little bit of a technical thing, but now the lines are all lit up, and we will get to them imminently. Again, the vote, not surprisingly, overwhelmingly close to 60% of white voters in 2006 in Michigan, 58% voted for the referendum, for the ban, and by a 9-1 margin, people of color who voted against it. Very briefly, what do you think about this class issue? And again, Marjorie would say this is preferable to race as a primary factor because it captures those who have most need, regardless of what the color of their skin is. If they're poor, they're poor. Derek Jackson thinks it misses the point completely. Do you?
No, I don't, because I think it does. That group was probably discriminated against in a different kind of way, even more harshly than certain minority sectors. So because they're invisible for the most part. So
I mean, poor white people.
Yeah.
In any case, now the lines are working. Let's go to Mark in Cambridge. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Emily Rooney. Hey there.
Hey there. How you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Jim, I'm actually Mark McGovern from the Cambridge
School Committee member there. Hey, Mark. Good to talk to you.
Now on the city council.
My apologies, Mark. I'm sorry. Yeah. By the way, did I get right? The criteria for Cambridge public school admission?
Yes.
I did.
And actually, one of the things I wanted to point out is that we actually just did a last term, did sort of took a look at our controlled choice policy. And since we made the switch to socioeconomic balancing as opposed to race balancing, our schools are actually, we have more schools that are in racial balance now than we had before, which
really
is sort of an odd, not what I expected to see, but that's. And that could be for a whole host of factors, but we actually have more schools that are racially balanced now. When you were talking about the schools and the schools in urban districts or poorer districts are not as good as other schools, the real key to this is universal early childhood education, and that goes across both class lines and race lines because these schools, certainly there are disparities in the schools, but the achievement gap exists before the kids even enter public school.
So you're saying that's a great leveler. I mean, that's Deval Patrick's position, too, and that's what creates some equality of opportunity.
Absolutely. It's a longer-term thing, and I think what happens in politics, certainly, is that people want to be able to show quick results.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to invest in early childhood education and not see the benefits of that for, you know, 15 years, 16 years down the road, you know, it's not as appealing to people to support, but all the research is really clear that that is the great equalizer. In terms of the decision, I haven't read the decision specifically, but it's unfortunate, I think. And I think when Emily, you had mentioned that, you know, colleges are going to know sort of who's applying, but I do think there is a subtle, unconscious, if you will, racism that plays into it. Where if you have two people of equal ability and you think, well, maybe the white applicant comes from a quote unquote better family, or maybe the white applicant, you know, going to stay the whole time and not I don't think it's necessarily a conscious.
Now there's no question.
Unfortunately, it probably is for some people, but I think most people, it's this subconscious and it's this white privilege that we don't even know that we have or that we're engaging in. That creates the discrimination.
Hey, Mark McGovern, city councilor in Cambridge. I hope you last on the council longer than I did. Thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it.
You know, on that point, Jim, Callie Crossley, our colleague here, just called in to say that the numbers in colleges and universities did not go up or meet the fairly paltry numbers that they did recently until the affirmative action laws were applied. So this is exactly what you're seeing, this atrophying of those numbers, maybe for the same reasons Mark McGovern was just saying, that, oh, well, you start weighing the pros and cons of somebody and looking at their background and say, oh, well, maybe this kid will stay and the minority kid won't for various reasons.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, though, what Mark says, and again, he was a former school committee member, is this whole, whatever he called a controlled choice thing that we have, where class is a higher an issue of higher importance at admissions. And he said it's led to greater racial integration and diversity in the schools. Question is,
maybe
is that an
Cambridge.
Outlier? I was just going to say, is it an outlier?
Yes.
I know Cambridge's an outlier.
Cambridge.
Okay, thank you very much, Emily. Cynthia, you're in Boston with Emily Rooney and Jim Brady. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
Just really quick, affirmative action came into being to level the playing field, as some of your guests have said, because of history from day one, you know, hundreds of years of history of white privilege that practiced against the welfare of black people and people of color, Latino. And so affirmative action for white people has existed all the time. And when they have programs that are supposed to help so-called poor people, they were understood the policies were it was already understood that it was the white people that would be helped. Black people had a fight. Historically, they had a fight to be able to get any kind of help at all. And there's plenty of books that have been written by black people who live in the suburbs who find out that even though they have the same amount of money and means, they're still practiced against because they're black.
Hey, Cynthia, but let me interrupt you just for a second. I don't want to speak for Justice Roberts. My guess is if he were listening, he'd say, hey, Cynthia, I totally agree there was a time and a place when affirmative action was necessary in this country, but that time has passed. How do you respond to that, Cynthia?
Well, that time hasn't passed because the same kind of policies, racist policies, are still being implemented across the board because a lot of people feel uncomfortable and are afraid when black people do well, and they do excel, whatever level of income they come from. And
hey,
I'll just hang up.
Cynthia, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those ones that you're certainly not going to win friends and influence people by taking the other side of this, you know. But there are legitimate questions that are being raised in 2014 about at what point do you think enough is enough with affirmative action? It's run its course. People have had the opportunity to excel, and if they don't, then they're just one of the ones who goes by the wayside.
So do you think we're going to have the great national conversation about a race starting today that we've been talking about for decades and decades?
Well, there's some very uncomfortable layers to it.
Look at the vote. I mean, by the way, none of this is a surprise, but it speaks to America still in 2014. 58% of whites voted for this. Mm-hmm. Apparently 10 or 11% of blacks and Latinos voted for this, which...
Of course, the population in Michigan is overwhelmingly white, but still.
Well, but in inner cities,
that's not the case.
I don't know what turnout there was either. Let's go to Jackie in Dorchester, on with Emily Rooney and Jim Brady. Hey, Jackie.
Hi. First of all, just so that you know, I went to the same high school as Irene Monroe.
Oh, we love Irene Monroe.
They're all
love
revved
Irene.
Up.
Wait, in Brooklyn? Where'd she go to high school?
In Brooklyn. Yeah, in Brooklyn. Samuel J. Tilden High School.
So wait a second. Before you go ahead, we learned 2 days ago she was a track star there. Do you remember that?
I didn't know. Well, first of all, I'm 10 years older than she is, and
okay.
I didn't meet her until I moved here to Boston.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
But no, I had no idea. Yeah. That was wonderful to
she
know
was
that.
Great. But go ahead, Jackie.
I leave a message for her. I'm the first generation who's benefited from busing in New York City, which had a very different trajectory. You know, my academic and professional career had an incredible positive trajectory because of it. Today, when I go back home, my nieces and nephews who live in the projects are still experiencing what I call the institutional racism that existed 50, 60 years ago. You cannot allow, schools are just one factor in what happens for a person. And when you're looking at zip codes, when you're looking at here in Boston where there's no school choice, and then you move that, you go up the line for colleges where if you're not prepared, you're not going to get in. What kind of room do we make for people in order to correct the wrongs of the past? The university systems, whether we're talking about students or even talking about the professors who get hired, are what they always have been. They lack diversity. I graduated from Northeastern with a graduate degree recently. I'm amazed at how few black students there are there. And I think that this decision is wrong. And I think Clarence Thomas, when you read excerpts of his book and his experience of going to school and how angry he still is about some of those experiences, I think he should have recused himself. I absolutely believe he should have recused himself.
That was a fitting end to your call. Jackie, we'll say hi to Irene next Monday for you. Thank you for a fine call. We appreciate it. By the way, there is a lot of anger in that man. If you hear him speak, I've never heard him speak live, but I've seen recordings. I've read excerpts from his books.
And he doesn't speak while he's on the court.
That is correct. By the way, he spoke a sentence several months ago, which is the first time he had spoken in 7 years. In my estimation, one of the major reasons why there are no cameras in federal courtrooms, I'm serious, is because the embarrassment that would cause one associate justice on the Supreme Court. Let's take one more quick one on this. Nick, you're in Cranston. You're on with Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy. Thank you for the call, Nick.
Hi, good afternoon. I just had a quick question about deciding large social issues by referendum. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that it's a great way for transparency, but I'm not sure if it leads to the best answer most of the time. I just was wondering what y'all's opinion were.
Well, we already spoke to that because here in Massachusetts, we haven't allowed that. We did not allow people to vote on gay marriage or interracial marriage or anything like that. That has not happened here in Massachusetts. It has happened in other states.
But let me say, in the spirit of full disclosure, Nick, and I rarely admit that I was wrong, but I will admit I was wrong here. I actually was in favor of having the question of gay marriage get on the ballot. And the reason for this was that I was totally convinced, this is really early on, that the pro-gay marriage forces would win. And until the voters spoke, we were going to hear for the rest of our natural lives. It was purely a bunch of elitist judges. They don't speak for anybody. But in retrospect, on issues like this, Nick, I admit I was wrong. So
letting women
I think you
vote,
make a good point.
Who should have taken that vote? Just the men?
Well, I mean, you know, by the way, there was an interesting, and Nick, thanks for the call. It was a really interesting statistic. We had Jeffrey Toobin on the show many months ago when we were talking. I can't even remember what the case was that came down. That morning,
Jody Arias?
No, we were not doing that. I don't know what we were talking about. We're talking about Loving versus Virginia, which obviously was a Supreme Court case, I think in the early 70s, about interracial marriage. Do you know that in the year that passed, the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to not allow people of different races to marry, that in the state in which it happened, close to 70% of people were against it. So the point, it makes Nick's point, that if you allowed popular referendum on some of these issues, we would never get anywhere. 1967, thank you, one of my colleagues, corrected my year, and thank you so much for your calls.
All right, Jim. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the judicial system from a different angle. Last week, the U.S. Attorney's Office cracked down on 3 unlicensed radio stations, among them Touch 106.1 FM. The co-founder of that station, Charles Clemens, joins us next. He's going to tell us what he's going to do about the fact that he's not on air anymore. That's next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
From the Xconomy Newsroom in Kendall Square, this is Greg Wong.
The Boston area is a rich resource of high-tech, biotech, energy, science, and technology. And WGBH's Xconomy Report is one way you can keep up with the people, companies, and trends making the news. Join Xconomy.com's Greg Wong for the latest involving Boston's innovation economy, Fridays during WGBH's Morning Edition, here on 89.7 WGBH. Our startup of the week
is... WGBH programs exist because of you. And SNH Construction, a general contracting firm serving the greater Boston area, specializing in residential renovations, custom building, historic restorations, renewable energy, and site work solutions. SHConstruction.com. And the 2014 Lincoln MKX, which comes with available adaptive HID headlamps and standard heated and cooled front seats. More details about the Lincoln MKX are available at Lincoln.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Emily Rooney is sitting in today for Marjorie Egan. Some of you know Charles Clemens is a 2013 mayoral candidate in Boston. Others might know him for his years walking the beat as a police officer. And anyone who lives in Dorchester within the reach of 106.1 FM knows him as Brother Charles, the host of the morning show. Last week, U.S. authorities, I'm sure you know, we've discussed it here, shut down a station, two other unlicensed outfits. He now joins us in Studio 3. Charles Clemens, good to see you again.
It's good to be seen, and it's a pleasure being here. And if I can correct you out of love.
Yeah, please.
We are 106.1 FM because there's a difference between letters and numbers.
Beautifully put. Thank you. I actually saw that on your website.
I know you like to call it that, but... It's close to whatever that other magic, whatever, and I think they were the one of the ones that was upset. Well, as you know, Charles, WGBH has been an ally in this to some degree. We were there with our cameras last week when the U.S. Marshals came in, and I have to say it was dramatic. If not, something struck me as just ridiculous about it, carrying away your antennas, carrying away your transmitter boxes. It was pathetic. And now I want to start by asking, did you get any notice at all that they were coming? Because the governor says he did.
Not a notice that they were coming on that particular date. No. No, we did not.
You had notice that there were problems. They had problems.
You had
not that that was the day.
And they had fined you. And they also claimed that they had given you an opportunity last fall sometime to actually apply for one of these low-level licenses for, you know, 100 watts or less. Did you miss that window, Charles?
Well,
what happened?
Well, let's be perfectly clear that the window has been closed for over 15 years when it comes to low-power FM radio. That's why I walked from Boston to Washington, D.C., 712 miles in 2009, to bring awareness the importance of having local radio stations in our community for our community. And then, of course, in 2010, the House of Representatives said, yes, I agree with Brother Charles and Prometheus Radio. 2011, the Senate agreed. And then, of course, President Barack Obama agreed to unlock the door for this. However, the Federal Communications, the FCC, finally decided to open that window in October. And as
right.
you both No, in October, I was just coming off for my campaign for the city of Boston, you know, taking the voice of the communities, those issues, and bringing them on the forefront.
But this is your livelihood, Charles. I mean, how could you miss an opportunity? You must have had some of you brought a colleague here today. There must have been somebody who could have helped you do that paperwork. Well, so this is what you
do. Whether the paperwork was done on October the 1st of 2013, It didn't matter, because whether you did it at that particular time, we still would have been unlicensed, because the process, there's a process that has to take place. You know, they had already decided that they were going to target Touch 106.1 FM because of the positive voice that we have, profanity-free, allowing elected officials to come on and be up close and personal with the community, locating lost children. So whether the paperwork was filled out in October or not, what happened on Thursday was still going to take place.
They took two other radio stations out at the same time.
Well, and I'm going to have to argue that point right there, because if there were two other radio stations, please name them.
I don't know what their names are. One was in Brockton and somewhere. Well, you're saying they didn't do it, Charles?
I'm saying, please name them. We know Touch 106.1 FM definitely was taken off the air.
You think it's not true that the others weren't? I'm not clear about what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that let's deal with the facts. And the facts is that Touch 106.1 FM.
But there have been others in the past. There was a big one here in Alston a couple of years ago, because we profiled that
actually
one,
Actually, it wasn't a couple of years ago. Margie, it was probably over
Emily.
10 years. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Emily.
That's okay.
Emily,
I've lost track. 10 years. I remember it.
It was over 10 years ago.
But they took that
ago.
One out, too.
Yes.
I want you to know we're profanity-free here, too, Charles.
Here
I just
are.
Want you to be clear. Okay. A couple of things, and then I want to get back to the case against Touch 106.1 in a second. The governor said, and I was actually amazed that he was as upfront about this. The governor said he was tipped off about this, that he discouraged the U.S. attorney from going in here. And with all due respect, while I know you're an important voice in the community, my estimation was, I said this to Emily, if the governor called the U.S. attorney, he's not calling about a huge international syndicate of criminals. He's calling about a local radio station that's got a lot of support. The governor calls the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney hears him and basically says, I don't care what you have to say. I'm going ahead and doing this, which leads me to the conclusion there's more there than we're reading about.
Absolutely.
Why do you think Carmen, what do you think Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. Attorney's agenda was here,
well,
Charles?
Well, I don't think she knows exactly what Touch has done for the community and the mission of Touch 106.1 FM. I believe she looked at documents and, you know.
You don't think Deval Patrick told her that? You don't think Deval Patrick said, I've been on the show repeatedly?
I can't.
I know it's technically illegal. I know there's an unpaid fine, which we'll get to in a minute. I know all this, Carmen Ortiz, but it's an important voice in this community. So don't do it.
Again, unless you have listened to Touch 106.1 FM, benefited from Touch 106.1 FM, and have been touched by Touch 106.1 FM, you will not feel the difference. And it's
should have had her on.
Absolutely.
Before we talk about the future, and you've talked to that you're going to fight on Charles Clemens, and we'll get to this in a couple
of
seconds.
Well, this is bigger. Can I say this?
You
this
can say whatever
bigger,
you want.
This is bigger than Charles Clemens. This is not about Charles Clemens. This is about our community. This is a civil rights and a human right issue that we're dealing with right here. We're dealing with giving a voice to the community. We're talking about inspiring people. We're talking about equaling the playing field. We're talking about the strongest, weakest link is that community that's unserved.
But Charles, even if that's true, then let me just go down a couple of quick things. One, the reality is, despite all those things, and most people who listen to or have been on your show and in the community seem to agree with you, one, the station was illegally on the air. I mean, that is a fact, correct?
We never denied that. But it was illegal. But it was illegal to sit in the front of the bus. It was illegal to look at white people straight in the face. It was illegal to walk on the same side of the street. It was illegal to laugh in front of white people. We had to put our head into a laughing barrel.
No, but
just because Charles, I know you compared this to Rosa Parks.
Listen,
this is not Rosa Parks.
Yes, it is Rosa Parks. It is in the spirit of Rosa Parks. We're talking about what is just because something's legal, it doesn't make it right.
Illegal. I see what you're saying. Okay. But let me continue.
It's 2014.
But you
and it's time for
it's
us.
It's not that you don't qualify to own a license. You can. I mean, our current boss used to work at another radio station. When you were on the air, he told us he went around with the equivalent of some kind of a Geiger counter trying to locate where your station was because it was interfering with one of his broadcasts that he paid for the license.
How about that issue? How about the
interference issue? I would disagree with that. This is one of the scare tactics that the FCC uses. It's been clearly documented, particularly when the FCC spent $2 million of taxpayers' money, hired a private company called Maitri, who did a survey in the inner city that simply said that low-power FM radio stations do not interfere with airplanes, do not interfere with other radio stations. Touch 106.1 FM had a 3.5-mile radius in beautiful Uptown Grove Hall. You couldn't even hardly hear us in Dudley. So how could we have been?
Well, I'll tell you, for starters, I worked down the hall from that radio station. We were in within the radius. And let's stay on that topic for a second.
Please.
We both know our boss pretty well. He is clearly a public-spirited kind of guy. If he said there was an issue, I believe there was an issue. WERS, for example, at Emerson, the head of which apparently supports what you're doing. He said the Brockton station that we do not know the name of, that is true, that was 0.2 down the dial, was interfering with the WERS signal. So, I mean, you're not saying that's – are you saying issue?
What I'm saying is that Touch 106.1 FM has been on the air for almost 8 years, providing quality service for our community. And if we had interfered with any other radio station, don't you think you would have heard about it a long time ago? What the issue is Touch 106.1 FM is growing. Touch 106.1 FM is inspiring the community. It's informing the community. That's what the issue is. You're either part of the solution or part of the problem.
Before we get to the fight ahead, and apparently you have a lot of powerful allies, not to mention the fact, Charles Clemens, that you've obviously decided that you're going to be an intimate part of this fight. There was a $17,000 fine that was assessed against you. I don't think you deny that from, was it 2008
Never did.
Or something?
Never did.
And the contention, just to get the facts out here, is that you didn't respond to it, you didn't pay it. Is that all accurate?
That's accurate.
And there are also contentions that during the mayoral campaign in 2013 that you were advancing your own candidacy, which concerns some people, which some suggest may have been a motivation. Is that accurate?
Yeah,
there,
that's,
or no?
that's an outright lie. What I did is I listened to the community. I went out and I took those issues of the community. And actually what happened is that Jimmy Myers came on and took my place on July 1st on Touch 106.1 FM. So how could that be possible?
Now, okay, so where do you go from here? You've got a pretty powerful ally, even though he wasn't powerful enough to stop the U.S. attorney, the governor. You have city councilors.
Well, I respect those in authority at that particular time.
So what do you do? What happens?
Can you make it an internet only? I know you went right up that night. I know you did.
We're on internet.
Can it work just as well on the internet?
This is about giving a voice to the community. And you both know not everyone has access to the internet. Not everybody has access to the community. That's why it's so important to have radio. When you go into war, the first line of defense is to knock out the radio communication. We both know this. So that's what has happened to the black community. The radio communication has been knocked out. Just like when we were taken from the shores of the motherland, the drums, our language was cut down. It's time for change. It's time for us to be one Boston. It's time for Boston not to be separated by racism, economics, and
classism. Charles, you should have participated in more of the debates that we have. You didn't even show up here on a very important debate we had right here at WGBH.
I wasn't invited, that's a whole
other
story.
You know darn well you were invited.
And hey, Charles, I thought about that, so but that's another story.
How do you get back on the air? I understand your rhetorical argument. I understand that. And by the way, you, as I've said seven times already, you are surely not alone. You have a lot of support. But how do you get from here to there? What does that mean?
What it means, if you believe in something and you love something enough, you will fight for it. And I am ready to fight. I will continue to fight for my community because I love my community. I have witnessed and experienced tragedy in my community. I live in my community. How could I possibly stand by and allow my community not to have a
voice? I know
voice.
A good basement for you, and I know where you can get a new antenna. Check out eBay.
Before you go, though, I'm assuming.
And I really want to thank you, too, for allowing us to have these airwaves.
Charles, I'm assuming that when people like the governor and city councilors and apparently members of Congress say they're going to fight with you, I'm assuming that the avenue that they're attempting to pursue, even though I don't know this for a fact, which is why I'm asking, is this low-power license thing that Emily broached with you a while ago. Regardless of the history that you described a minute ago, it seems to me that's the only way the FCC would grant that, if there's no interference issue and all that sort of thing. Is that the route that elected officials are pursuing?
This fight is going to take place on the federal level.
Is that what they're looking for as the solution?
The solution is to get Touch 106.1 FM.
No, I know, but how, Charles?
I'm not a lawyer. We're going to do it the right way. We're going to fight for what's right. And we're going to give the community a voice.
What a voice. Speaking of voice, by the way, this is one heck of a voice, as they say.
Profanity-free, remember that.
It is. I stopped myself.
So far it is.
Charles, thank you for your time.
Thank
we appreciate
you very much. And
you.
I want to thank the governor. I want to thank Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Ed Markey, Congressman Capuano, the local elected officials, City Councilor at Large Ayanna Presley, Michelle Wu. I'd love to thank the community.
What does it say that these people, I can't think of five issues where that group of people have been united and they can't keep a 100-watt radio station on the air?
This time
for
change.
What does that say?
It's 2014.
I know it's
time
2014,
for
Charles.
Right, Charles, thank you so much.
Charles Clemens. Well. Love you all.
Co-founder, Touch 10. Do I have that right?
You got it right.
6FM, his station along with two others, as we said, was shut down. Up next, it's Law and Order with David Frank, managing editor of Mass Lawyers Weekly. Stay tuned for his read on the latest court cases on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
When Beacon Hill outlawed upskirting, it inadvertently called attention to political dirty secrets of its own. If you missed it on the radio, check out investigative reporter Rupa Shenoy's revealing story at WGBHnews.org right now.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH through our vehicle donation program. Visit WGBH.org/car donation.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at harvardvanguard.org and experience better care for a better life.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney sitting in for Marjorie Egan, who will return tomorrow. I'm Jim Browdy. Here with us in Studio 3 for Law and Order, BME, as in Boston Marathon Edition, is managing editor of Mass Lawyers Weekly, David Frank. He is what you would call an also-ran. Last year, he was just shy of crossing the finish line before the bombs went off. This year, David crossed it, which I guess explains his stooped demeanor. David, congratulations. Good to see you.
Thank you very much. It was a long day. But I'm standing and I'm still alive.
You feel great, right? I mean, not
no.
physically,
Do
but
we
in
dare
your head.
Ask your time?
I could lie to you, Jim, and say, yeah, I feel great. No, I don't feel great. My legs are barking. Yeah. My feet are not good. I'll be a typical lawyer and be really vague. I was hoping, Emily, to run under 4 hours. And I ran just under 5 hours.
Yeah.
It was hot out there.
Yeah.
And I'm old.
I'm impressed.
No,
the fact that
it's really great you did it, and it was a really important day, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
So, David, the marathon is behind us, and I think there's a collective sigh of relief for all of us that we can put that, and it went off great. It was a fantastic day. But now people start talking again about the upcoming trials. So we've got two. Jahar Tsarnaev, of course, is scheduled later in the fall. But these three college kids, these three associates of Jahar Tsarnaev who were picked up right after, you know, they are allegedly threw his computer away and got rid of some other evidence in his room. That trial is scheduled to come up in June, which is really just, you know, a month and a half away. And there's some noise being made about them asking for a change of venue. What do you think will happen there?
I don't know. And that's not a great answer on radio because I'd love to have a definite answer. But that is going to be a fascinating argument. All three defendants have filed motions for change of venue.
These are UMass Dartmouth people, for those who don't. Two of them
are UMass
okay,
Dartmouth
fine.
And one kid from Cambridge.
One of them's out on bail.
Correct.
And two are still being held.
Yeah. Two of them have immigration issues that are separate and apart from the case. But if you look at what they filed, they all have said that the amount of coverage, the nature of the coverage, has been so one-sided, so unfair, so prejudicial, that they're saying there's no way in the world they can get a fair trial in Massachusetts.
Except no one could name their names. Not one of us. Not one of us could do it. Nobody could.
But I don't know if that's a prerequisite to being fair and impartial. Everybody here was impacted by it. The McVeigh case is probably the closest analogy. Mm-hmm. The judge there moved
Oklahoma City bombing, for those who don't recall. God, I'm sorry.
And that case got moved out of town. Judge Woodlock is the judge that's going to deal with the three kids.
He's tough.
He is tough. No judge likes to move cases out of town. The government is going to say that it would be totally unfair, totally inconvenient to have to pick up and move their case to some other state. But at the end of the day, the defense is moving for it. And if the judge says no and forces these people to trial, you're going to be creating issues on appeal. I would expect that this venue question won't be resolved until jury selection, when people actually come in and are questioned in the courtroom. This is a tough one. Most times I always say, judge is going to keep it in town.
Yeah.
This one's not, I'm not so sure.
Well, it's also a hardship on the victims. I mean, I spoke to a number of them in recent weeks, and some of them have had a change of heart about attending these trials. Roseanne Sedoya, who lost a leg, originally told me she had no interest. Now she says she does. Jeff Bowman, who lost both legs, said, it's kind of sweet. He says, I've never been in a courtroom in my life. I want to go in. I want to be able to look at the people who allegedly did this to me. So to put those people all in that kind of a hardship situation would seem
is that
cruel.
Part of it? That's a great point. Can a judge when a judge decides whether or not whether or not defendants can get a fair trial or not, when he or she is deciding the venue issue, is it appropriate to consider the hardship to the survivors of the acts when they're making the determination? Is that even relevant?
It's relevant. It's a factor. By statute, by law, victims have the right to participate in the proceedings, but certainly with witnesses. I mean, there are going to be witnesses
That's a great point too.
Who may not want to be a part of it, but are going to be. And Bauman is clearly going to be a witness in this case.
Bauman.
Oh, definitely. Bauman.
So, but wait a second. So let's assume if the three associates, for lack of a better expression, are granted a change in venue, how does the judge in the Tsarnaev case itself not grant a change in venue, assuming it's requested? It seems to me what's good for the goose in this case, if the three second-tier players or fourth-tier mm-hmm. players can't get a fair trial, then how can you possibly exactly. argue that the alleged killer can get a fair trial?
And I mean, that obviously is a huge issue. I think one of the things the government may argue in that scenario is that these three defendants are going to trial in the immediate aftermath of this anniversary, where you had the events leading up to the race and where the polling that's been done would suggest that emotions are higher now than they have been probably since last April. And perhaps the argument would go from the prosecution standpoint that by November, some of that emotional attachment from what we've just gone through would be lower. But I agree. If Judge Woodlock grants the motion for change of venue, Judge Saylor, who is trying the Tsarnaev case, I think would be in a very mm-hmm. difficult position.
David, on the three kids for a second, is there anything for them to plead to at this point? I mean, they've been in jail for a year. One of them, as I said, is out. Yeah. But what would they acknowledge doing? I mean, accessory after the fact. I mean, what would they plead to if they were going to try to work a plea deal? Or is there no such thing in this case?
Well, I mean, there's been nothing to indicate that there is any discussion about pleas. Obviously, the closer you get to a jury being impaneled, the closer and the more likely it becomes that you get a plea. They could plead to the charges and perhaps get a couple of years in prison. And two of them, as I mentioned, have immigration issues. But this is not a situation, based on what we know, where the government needs any of these three defendants to cooperate against Tsarnaev. It does not appear that their alleged role in the case is that connected to what happened on Marathon Monday. So I don't know that the government has much incentive to make deals.
You know, I'm assuming, David, who's the editor of Maslers Weekly, you're totally intimidated by Emily Rooney, because this is the longest you've ever been in the studio where you've not worked in the website of your publication. So is that because of something? What is it? What is the website again?
Well, that's a great question.
Thank you.
It's masslawyersweekly.com.
That's what I heard.
David Frank MLW is practically destroying Twitter. It's going to crush
it. Okay, fine. Now, David, let's get to the Tsarnaev case. An outside observer who doesn't do what you do every day and is involved in all the minutiae as well, you shouldn't. You do it extraordinarily well at your publication.
Oh, what do you mean?
The sense I get is this case is all about Judy Clark and working to ensure that the younger Tsarnaev, when convicted, is not executed. Judy Clark is the lawyer whose specialty is to come in and convince juries after a person is convicted of a capital crime that for a variety of reasons they shouldn't be put to death, and she's pretty successful. Is that an overstatement or an unfair characterization? I'm not saying they're not going to contest the charges, but it is all about keeping them alive, isn't it?
No, I think you got that one wrong, Jim.
Why?
Because it's a death penalty case. They're broken up into two phases. The defense lawyers are obligated at this stage of the case to prepare for both.
Certain, well, I understand they're prepared.
And the reason I say that is because in some circumstances, and Gary Sampson is one of the last federal death penalty cases in Massachusetts, was a situation where Sampson didn't contest the underlying charges. That could happen. I'm just saying there's been nothing at this point to suggest that that is going on.
So assuming you're right, and you do know more about this, as painful as it is for me to admit, than I do, what we all read is that the defense on the underlying charges are going to be about this is a young kid who's got no record, who was under the evil influence of his older brother, who we've learned more and more mm-hmm. about in terms of his radicalization and all these sort of things. Is that the defense in this case?
That's phase two, because death penalty cases, there are 30 indictments in which the government is asking a jury to find him guilty. 17 of the 30, and this is a little bit complicated, but 17 of the 30 charges carry the possibility of a death sentence. So if the jury comes back on any one of those 17 with a guilty verdict, you then move to phase two.
I was arguing that that is phase one, that they're essentially saying he knows not what he did. He was totally, I don't know if it's a mental illness thing or mentally incompetent thing, but essentially this is a kid who basically had no ability
to
make decisions. Why can't they do
that? I just don't think that's the direction
they're
going.
So what's the defense in phase one?
Well, I think they will, part of the defense will be that the brother did it, that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother, did it. And Dzhokhar was just along for the ride. That's perhaps one of the defenses. I don't know. And obviously, I've been following this closely. I've been to every court hearing. I was there last week. And I'm listening closely and reading closely to see where the defense may be going on phase one. They're keeping their cards very close to the vest. The prosecution has now begun to try to get Judge O'Toole to order the defense to give up some information about where they're going. But they're intentionally not disclosing a lot right now.
So on this change of venue thing, Jim and I and Marjorie, we're all fixated on this. Are we any closer? Is there any possibility ever that there could be a camera put into this courtroom?
Nope, unfortunately not. I've got a story coming out soon, and I talked to Senator Grassley, and Jim, you'll remind me what state he...
Iowa.
Exactly.
Who's been a champion on this issue, by the way. He's been great.
He's also been about 0 for 8 in filing legislation that's gone nowhere. There's two ways it could happen. Neither one are going to happen anytime soon. You could see something on the congressional side, or you could see the United States Supreme Court enact rules that would basically amend those that are currently in place. They're not going to do it. They don't have a good explanation. Many of the judges and recently retired Justice Souter, he said words to the effect that over my dead body will I allow cameras in the courtroom. It's crazy. Believe it or not, and this is true because I've now researched it, it goes back to this notion that the O.J. Simpson trial ruined the court system. And it's an antiquated idea. State court, we could go down the street to Suffolk Superior Court, to Middlesex Superior Court, the Neil Entwistle trial, the McCowan trial, Aaron Hernandez. Those cases are all recorded. There are video cameras. There's recording devices. The buildings have not collapsed, and justice has been done. There's no good reason, but it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, we said a while ago, and we all three are obsessed with, and I have a feeling you're borderline obsessed. The point that Marjorie makes all the time, and in her stead, I'll make it for her, is one of the arguments, particularly in this case, for an exception which will not be made, is Emily was talking a minute ago about some of the survivors who she's interviewed who didn't want to go, now do. Look, even if there's no change in venue, what they have to go through to get there, and there's a real serious issue. Let's assume of the 200 and some survivors, let's assume, I know this is not going to happen, but theoretically, let's assume every one of them wants to go, and a lot of them need assistance. So 200 and some people become 350 people. There's no room in the courtroom. So they go to the overflow. But that the overflow room, at least from what I heard, has a camera and a fixed position that basically doesn't give you a feel for what's going on. Why are you making a face?
I totally agree with what you're saying. Maybe selfishly, I'm one of the few people working in newspaper who covers these things. I selfishly probably benefit from this ridiculous rule that doesn't have them in there.
Because the cameras don't.
Because we got to ask you
right. Because I have to come in and talk about it. But and I love it. But what I would say, we already saw what you were discussing about where victims or alleged victims wanted to come in and observe it and couldn't.
Whitey Bulger.
Well, and even last July, the one time that Tsarnaev has come to the Moakley courthouse was for his arraignment after he was indicted. And there were people turned away at the door who could not watch in person, who wanted to watch, who were impacted in some way by what happened.
Do you remember the only view we got of Tsarnaev? Do either of you remember how we got it? Russian videographer was in the overflow room and improperly took a video
of
the overflow room screen and put it online.
Yeah.
The
only reason I wanted to disagree, though, is that I can't remember if I was in the courtroom for Tsarnaev's arraignment or if I watched it on the overflow, but it actually, the technology is pretty good. I mean, you've got high definition screens in these courtrooms that are able to have split screens of the judge and the defendant. And to me, that speaks to the ridiculousness of the issue. It's not a technological problem for why cameras can't be in there. It's a old judge problem. It's the United States Supreme Court wanting to change it.
Some of these victims, and I won't name any of them, we're unaware. One of them said to me, "Well, I'm not going to watch it on TV all day." And I said, "Well, you know, you're not going to be able to. They don't know. They don't
know because all state court proceedings are able to be broadcast.
So this is going to come as a shock to a lot of people.
That's a wonderful point. You know, one last thing about this, David. I know what your answer is going to be, but we'll go there anyway. Emily and I were talking before about the Supreme Court decision in this a race as a factor in admission decision out of Michigan. I am convinced that if Clarence Thomas ever spoke on the Supreme Court, which he has one sentence in 7 years, literally, if for people who think I'm exaggerating, he has not spoken with the exception of one sentence in 7 years, because of the embarrassment of having a camera in that courtroom where eight men and women would be talking all the time and one would be sitting there mute, I think that is a huge issue in the Supreme Court in 2014. It's not 1960 anymore. Is that a ridiculous point of view?
No, it's not a ridiculous point of view.
Oh, I'm surprised. Okay.
There is an accountability factor when the public observes what happened. Courtrooms are supposed to be open. You're supposed to be able to open the door and observe it. And in the 21st century, where people can look at things on telephones and computers, the idea that the public can't watch these cases that have tremendous public importance is crazy.
Speaking of public importance, just change gears. We'll do this briefly because virtually no one, unfortunately, knows who this person is or knows anything about him. We know that Roderick Ireland, the Chief Justice of the SJ Supreme Judicial Court, was required to resign because he's 70 this summer. The governor appointed a replacement the other day who needs confirmation by the pathetic governor's council, but that's a topic for another day. Ralph Gantz is the next Chief Justice, assuming he's confirmed. Give us the quick version on the qualifications, the skill, the appropriateness of this elevation.
It's a 10 out of 10. And Judge Gantz, I appeared in front of him as a lawyer. I've obviously covered him at Lawyers Weekly. Before he was appointed to the Supreme Judicial Court, he was sitting in Superior Court, and he presided over the business litigation session for a good chunk of his tenure. He handled really the complex sort of business disputes that get brought into state court. And a prolific writer, a smart writer, some of his cases would go up on appeal, but he was the kind of judge who would be dealing with the difficult issues. Mm-hmm. He's a former federal prosecutor. He has plenty of experience on the criminal end. He treats lawyers really well, which is something I like. He gives everybody an opportunity to be heard. And then he writes well.
How does he feel about cameras in the courtroom? No, seriously, because Roderick Ireland was very opposed to it.
Is that so? I wasn't aware of that.
I did a documentary 10 years ago about the state Supreme Judicial Court, and he was one of two judges who refused to participate, didn't want to be filmed, didn't want to be interviewed. He just thought it was a sacred process and didn't want any part of it.
And yet the court itself, for your piece, gave you a lot of access.
They did. But he was not one.
I can't speak for Judge Gantz on that because I haven't asked him. But the majority of judges that I talk to, and federally and statewide, are in favor of cameras in court. And we've seen it in state court, and plenty of judges allow it.
Two last things on this judge issue. One of the issues that arises is Gantz is 59, which means he's only allowed to serve as Chief Justice, assuming he's confirmed, for 11 years. First thing is anybody looking at the absurdity in 2014 when 70 is no longer 70, that a judge is no longer allegedly useful at 70 in Massachusetts? Well, let's do that first. Is anybody looking at that, or is that just a pipe dream?
Well, as someone who just got under 5 hours in the marathon, I'm all for the aging process and taking care of those getting older. You hear about it every so often. I haven't seen anything, any sort of push that might be coming. You do see judges on occasion get recall status where after they reach 70, they get brought back onto the court.
Absolutely.
To help out with the overflow. Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen it.
And the second thing that we were actually discussing with Charlie Baker, and I don't want to mischaracterize his position, even though I was here talking to him about it yesterday. I think he agrees with me that we didn't discuss election of judges, which is a whole much more radical
horrible
notion.
Idea.
I knew
horrible.
You felt that way. I don't feel that way. But in any case, I actually believe in democracy, unlike you two. But putting that aside, Mitt Romney, and I'm paraphrasing, I thought was a great idea. Not term limits for judges, but a re-upping of judges. Every X number of years, I think it was 10, I'm not sure, you may know, they get reviewed.
By who?
And if essentially, well, I don't
you?
Know, the state senate.
By Jim Browdy.
By state senate, maybe even the governor's council.
Yeah, as long as Jim's doing it.
No,
yeah.
I'm serious. Somebody every 10 years or every X number of years would review a judge, and if he or she is doing a fine job, they're re-upped. If they're not,
I'm going to make you do that with your license.
They're not re-upped. You don't like
test.
That either.
No, that's a horrible idea.
Lifetime tenure is great.
Lifetime tenure is great. We don't want judges making decisions to appease the public, to get reappointed, to get reelected.
So why shouldn't governors be elected for life so that they don't make decisions based upon popular ebbs and flows in opinion.
I went to school down the street. I bet we can get you into a social studies class. They have three branches of government.
Yeah.
Each one plays a different role. Judges, the legislative, the judicial branch, cannot be in a position where they have to worry about the things
that there'd be cameras in the courtroom if judges were re-upped every 10 years? I would say the answer is a big fat yes. Wouldn't you say?
No.
Yes.
Why haven't your elected officials in Congress or the executive branch?
I'll tell you why. Because I would bet, and this is based on some research, having read some stuff you wrote, Edgar B. Herrick III did some research for us from the Curiosity Desk. I would be willing to bet you, if you called the 435 members of Congress in the House right now and the 100 members of the Senate and said, why don't you vote to amend the rules that apply to federal courts, that 534 out of 535 would say,
I didn't know.
We don't have the power to do that. That's the Supreme Court of the United States. Is that, that's not much of an exaggeration, do you think? Is it, David Frank?
It's a slight exaggeration. If they read in a couple of weeks at masslawyersweekly.com, we cover
a lot. That's your website?
It's funny you say that. Yeah, yes, it is.
Speaking of that, last thing from me, and Emily and I were discussing this. You wrote a great piece in 2007. That's sort of when you peaked, don't you think? A lot of people think.
It's been downhill since 2007.
You wrote a piece in 2007 when there was this really high-profile, horrible case where a judge in Massachusetts let somebody out, and ultimately the person, I think, went off to Washington State, am I right? And
you're
killed
right.
Oh, a young couple or
some
such thing. And there was an issue about whether or not this judge in this case should stand up and explain herself in this. A higher judge did it. And you wrote a piece which, well, addressing the whole issue of the conventional wisdom that judges are not permitted to discuss either pending
themselves.
Or former cases. Tell us the conclusion you reached.
Well, the conclusion back in 07, which is really still the same today, don't make me do the math, whatever 14 minus 7 is, 7. The conclusion was that the rules are murky, that the rules aren't clear on what judges can and can't do without getting into trouble. Some of the judges I talked to, and the always outspoken retired Superior Court Judge Robert Barton, was saying that a judge anytime could essentially draft a memo to the file, put something in the file as to what happened to try to explain him or herself.
And by the way, he was the chair of the Commission on Judicial Conduct, which is in charge of this issue. So you would assume he knows what he's talking about, no?
No, he's a brilliant, smart guy. And if he's listening, hi, Judge. But the counter is also very legitimate here because you've got judges who are recognizing an ambiguity or a gray area in the rules about what they can and can't say. So what judge with lifetime tenure who has to follow the rules is going to risk it? And there's another issue. It's not. It's easier said than done, Jim, and we've already argued about this.
Well, we're going to argue again
not,
in a minute.
Not every judge can remember a decision they made on a bail 5 years ago.
So they should say that. I don't remember it. The thing speaks for itself.
But I mean, some of them have spoken. I've actually interviewed Mark Wolf. You know, who
federal court judge, many high profile
cases. He will talk about the law and the decision making process, but he's not going to get into the specifics of like.
Well, it's fine.
He sat on the Gary Lee Sampson case. He was the judge on that.
Yeah, but the part of this that is most appalling to me is not that 99% of judges. I mean, that was the infamous line in the long Jerry Remy piece by Eric Moskowitz in the Globe. Judges either were unable to respond or comment on any of these things, whatever the verbiage was. What's amazing to me is there is a gray area. The Commission on Judicial Conduct should make it clear. You can speak, and here's what you can speak on, or you can't speak. The fact that years after, we still have judges who are confused about what rules apply to them is embarrassing. It is total. If you want to ban them from speaking, I'm against it, but clarify that.
They're not banned.
Well, whatever they are, as David Frank sort of knows what he's talking about. He said it's a murky area. Mm. Make it unmurked. Isn't that a fair statement?
It's fair, and you could say that about lots of laws and lots of things that exist in our society, that there are ambiguities.
Yeah, but if you want to build confidence, if the concern of judges, as you said about the camera issue, is to build confidence or strengthen confidence in the system, then they should make clear what a judge can do so that people like me in controversial cases can't say that judge is hiding behind a faux prohibition. Would you not agree with that?
No, it's a fair question. Shame on me for allowing 7 years to lapse without following up on it.
We should follow up on it because there was a big conference. I attended it probably about 7 years ago or longer where judges were, this was all about, this is what the discussion was. There was tons of judges there, and they were talking about when they can speak and when they can't. I can't remember. Probably your outfit put it on. I can't remember.
So when you recover from the marathon,
wait,
you
Emily,
get
that
on
outfit
this or
being
what?
MassLawyersWeekly.com.
Yes, yeah. It was. Hey, David, it's a pleasure as always. And this big thing on cameras is coming out soon. And
it's coming out soon.
Great. We'll be reading it. David Frank, Mass Lawyers Weekly. Pleasure as always.
All right, David Frank, thank you so much. I don't know where I am right now.
You don't?
No. Up next, bringing global warming down to Earth by way of Walden Pond.
Exactly.
How a BU biologist and a team of students are using Thoreau's notes from the 1800s to prove climate change in the 21st century. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Washington goes wireless?
While I'm out in the district, I can bring up my phone and vote that way. And so I think it's just a way to bring Congress into the 21st century.
So via the internet, we can Skype, we can talk remotely to relatives, conduct job interviews, and even hear from Edward Snowden. So why not politics? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting the Reduced Shakespeare Company in the Complete History of Comedy, Abridged, April 24th to May 18th. More information and tickets available at mrt.org. And Safety Insurance, committed to safe driving. Safety Insurance would like to remind Massachusetts drivers that it is illegal to text and drive. You can learn more at safetyinsurance.com. Be safe. Don't text and drive.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Every April 22nd, the world makes a point of observing Earth Day. But one day seems sort of like chump change when you consider what Henry David Thoreau moved to a small cabin at Walden Pond. And for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days, he wrote down everything that he observed. And more than 10 years in the making, BU biologist Richard Primack has picked up things where Thoreau left off. His new book is called Walden Warming, Climate Change Comes to Thoreau's Woods. He is here with us to explain why he did it and what he found. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming in. So before we get to Walden Pond, you have been all over the place. You've been in Malaysia and Central America and all around the world researching these tropical forests. And then you came back, you know, so close to BU, so close, almost in your backyard. So why? Why'd you do that?
Well, 13 years ago, I was working on a new edition of my textbook in conservation biology, and I was struck by the fact that we didn't have any really good examples of climate change from really anywhere in the eastern United States. And so 13 years ago, I decided with my students that we would see if we could just walk outside of our biology building at Boston University or just go anywhere in the metropolitan Boston area and see the fingerprint of climate change. And we tried to find just old records of when plants were flowering or when birds were migrating. And we started to look for whatever evidence we could find. And within a couple of months of searching, we just stumbled across Thoreau's records, which turned out to be the real gold mine of research in this area.
Wait a minute. How did you stumble upon his records?
Well, stumbled on in the fact that for several months, myself and my students were just asking every person we knew if they had any old records of of just any biological events or how abundant species were in the Boston area. We started to put up notices in libraries and supermarkets. We went to all the little botanical clubs and bird clubs in the Boston area and asked people. And then after doing this for several months, a friend of mine named Phil Cafaro, who was formerly a BU graduate student, is now a professor at Colorado State, asked us, why didn't we check on Thoreau's records, his flowering records? And we said we had didn't know about these. And he said, well, of course, all Thoreau scholars know about these records, that during the 1850s, Thoreau made very detailed observations of flowering time and bird arrival times. And in the late 1850s, put these into the form of tables, which have never been published. They're well known to Thoreau scholars, so all Thoreau scholars know about these tables, but biologists don't know about them. And so once we found out about them and once we got a copy of them, I mean, we just knew that this was exactly what we were looking for.
Very detailed, to use your words, Richard, is an understatement for what he did. Tell us exactly, first of all, where'd you find it, and what did you find?
So what Phil told us was that these tables, that there were tables, the original tables are in New York City at the Morgan Library, but the copies of them were held by someone named Brad Dean, who was an independent Thoreau scholar living in New Hampshire. And so once I called up Brad Dean and asked him if he had the copies and could he let us have them, he said sure, he would be glad to send them to us. And by the way, did we know that they would be very important in climate change research? He said he knew that someday someone would contact him about these records, a biologist, and here we were the biologist showing up in his doorstep.
And your goal, obviously, was to show how things had changed in the 160-plus years in terms of plant species, that sort of thing. But one of the major hurdles in everything we read was apparently Thoreau's handwriting is completely undecipherable. Is that right?
Not indecipherable, but very difficult to
indecipherable,
discover.
That is correct.
We got several days after contacting Brad Dean, we got a photocopy of the records that he sent us. And it has the flowering time. The first set of records we got was the flowering time of over 300 plant species that Thoreau had looked at from 1851 to 1858. So he went all around in Concord, only within the limits of Concord, recording the flowering times. And when we got the records, they were very challenging because, first of all, it was very difficult to figure out what he did. And eventually we realized that each set of pages represented 2 or 3 years of observations for about 300 plant species, or more than 300 plant species. Also, his handwriting is extremely difficult to read. It's not impossible, but it's just very difficult. But the challenge is that he started off using common names, many of which were different from our modern common names, and then he changed over to scientific names, many of which are different from our present scientific names, and he also sometimes abbreviated the names. So it was very difficult to actually match up his names that he was using in the 1850s with his bad handwriting with our modern scientific names.
We're talking with BU biology professor Richard Primack, who's been studying Thoreau's findings up in Walden Pond for years now. Was the handwriting difficult because it was bad handwriting, or it was tiny handwriting, or the ink had faded? What was the problem?
It's all the problems you can imagine.
Okay.
So the problem was that he was writing relatively small, but the main problem was that he just had bad handwriting.
Okay.
So it was actually very difficult to actually determine what the words are. But also, the challenge was that he was using often antiquated names. So it's imagine if you were trying to translate something, you know, in bad handwriting from Spanish into English and you didn't speak Spanish.
And did he just have, were there even spiral notebooks in the 1850s? I mean, what were the records kept on?
He was writing them on blank sheets of white paper, actually on survey paper.
No staples.
No, he wasn't using staples. He was just using these kind of blank sheets of survey paper. But, I mean, they just looked like columns out of a spreadsheet. So, you know, you could just, on the surface, you could just take his records and put them into an Excel spreadsheet, which is what we did. The challenge was actually figuring out what the words were.
Before we get to what you found in your decade or so of research, Richard Primack, were you a Walden Pondophile before this? I mean, you're a local guy. Were you into it? Did you used to hang out there or no?
No, I don't think that I'd ever been to Walden Pond before this study began. And I think I'd only been to Concord a couple of times growing up, maybe just to see the Old North Bridge at Minuteman National Historical Site. Our family did not really have very much interaction with Concord, and I didn't really know very much about it growing up. So for me, this was kind of a real opportunity. Yet many people around me, for example, my brother and many of my friends, were extremely interested in Thoreau. But, I mean, I was aware of Thoreau, but didn't really know much about it. But since then, I've become an extreme Thoreau lover in the fact that I not only have read Walden Pond at least once a year over the last 13 years, but there was actually one month where I read Walden four times.
Well, before we do get to what you found, because I think it's such a fascinating thing to do, to spend 2 years and 2 months, or whatever it was, as Thoreau did, at Walden Pond. What kind of a guy was he? Can you get any sense from having lived, you know, to follow in his footsteps as you have?
Well, Thoreau, first of all, Thoreau was a genius. I mean, it's one thing which people are recognizing, that he was one of the originators of so many academic fields in the United States. So not only did he write about the need to live simply, so not only was he a great practical philosopher, but he was also a political activist. He was very interested in Native American affairs, map making. He was just so brilliant in so many areas. In particular, he was really been neglected as a scientist. So he actually had great insights into how the world worked, how the natural world worked. And made very detailed observations, which are really forerunners of the modern field of ecology. But also, he was a great writer. So when you read Walden today, you just keep getting nuggets of great information from him. He was also, at the same time, he was very skeptical of society. He was very skeptical of the hypocrisy of society. And yet he was very engaged in society because he felt that there were great wrongs being done in the world on issues of slavery and issues of war. And so he was very actively engaged in society and trying to make it a better place.
Why did he make these observations? Why did he record these observations for so long with such colossal detail? What was his agenda? What was his goal?
Well, we really don't know. So the presumption is that in addition to writing Walden and various other books, he was also planning to write, he had a number of other book ideas that he had in mind, but that he never completed because of his untimely death. It's probable that he was planning to write a book about the seasons. In the same way, if you read Walden, Walden is about the change in seasons over the course of a year around Walden Pond. But the reason that he was making so many of these observations, he was also concerned with how year-to-year variation affected the natural world, like how a very cold winter or a very mild winter affected Walden Pond, or how a late frost or an early frost might be affecting the biology of birds and wildflowers. So he was probably going to write a book about in detail about the variation in the seasons, but he never got around to this.
How old was he when he died?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I'm actually not sure.
He
was in his 40s.
Oh, wow. How depressing is that, Jim?
Okay, so 150, 160 years passes, or 150, and you all of a sudden come along. Mm-hmm. And tell us what you did and what kind of analysis you did, and then tell us the bad news.
Well, as soon as we got his records, we realized that the obvious thing to do was to repeat his observations. So he went around from 1851 to 1858 recording the day of the first open flower for over 300 plant species in Concord, within the political limits of Concord. And we started to do the same thing. 2003, our great challenge was actually just to find where the plants were. So we actually spent a lot of time in 2003 just roaming around Concord and getting to know the plants and the locations in Concord. But beginning in 2004, we began to make exactly the same kind of observations that Thoreau made, and that also another botanist named Alfred Hosmer made in Concord from 1878 to 1902. And what we found was that plants, they flower earlier in warm years and they flower later in cold years, and that the conditions in general are much warmer now than in Thoreau's time. So the temperatures in the Boston area have gotten about 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer since the time of Thoreau. And so we began observing that in general, the plants were flowering anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks earlier than in Thoreau's time. And that particular years, such as 2010, which was an extremely warm year, and then 2012, which was a record-breaking warm year, that the plants flowered about 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks earlier than in Thoreau's time. So there's been a huge shift in the flowering time of plants in Concord and also the leafing out time of plants in Concord, and to a lesser extent, the bird arrival times. And this is really being driven by temperature.
And why should we care that the flowering time is earlier, Richard Premack?
the reason that we should care, I mean, I'm a native New Englander. I grew up in the Boston area in Newton, Massachusetts. And I can tell you as a native New Englander, the idea of a milder winter and earlier spring is kind of appealing. Mm. But it's actually an indicator of really negative things which are going to happen, really destructive things which are going to happen in coming decades. So from a biological perspective, milder winters means we're going to have more invasive insects which are going to be killing the trees. We're going to be having a longer tick season which can spread Lyme disease. Also, when it's warmer and this has the effect of drying out the wetlands in the spring and the summer, which means that a lot of our endangered salamanders and turtles, a lot of the wildflowers which live in wetlands, are not going to have a place to live. But it also means very destructive influences for the city of Boston. For example, we're going to have great heat waves in Boston in coming decades if we continue to have this warming, which will harm people. And also, we're going to have rising sea levels as the ocean continues to expand because of heat and also because of the melting polar ice caps and glaciers. And cities like Boston and New York are extremely vulnerable to rising sea level. If the sea level just gets a few inches higher, Boston is in real danger of the massive flooding which occurred in New York City during Hurricane Sandy. And other cities around the United States, like Miami, are similarly vulnerable.
So, Richard Premack, a climate change denier sees your work, looks at the comparative analysis that you've done with the work, the meticulous work that Thoreau did. What does he or she say to dismiss what you've done? Have they done it yet? And if they haven't, make the case that theoretical denier would make.
Well, the one thing which has to be made about our studies is that our study is not primarily about the effects of climate change in the metropolitan Boston area. It's not about global climate change. It's about the climate change we're happening in Boston. So about two-thirds of the warming that we've had in the metropolitan Boston area is due to urbanization. So about one-third of it is due to global climate change, and the other two-thirds is due to urbanization.
And explain urbanization. What does that mean?
So urbanization means we've cut down the trees in the metropolitan Boston area. We have parking lots, roads, and buildings which absorb the sunlight rather than reflect it the way trees would do. So Boston has had as much warming over the last 160 years due to urbanization and global climate change as the rest of the country will experience due to just climate change. So Boston is a very good place to see the effects of future climate change. So Boston is not, the studies that we've done don't really reflect the climate change, which has already happened. It's this combination of things. So that's kind of one comment about our studies. But our study is very good for showing what will happen in the future.
Is it just a death watch? I mean, are we essentially, assuming that people continue to debate, I mean, we've mentioned Los Angeles Times won't print letters from people who deny climate change anymore, but mm-hmm. they're the outlier. So we read your work. We look at the comparison, and we just look at our watch and start count. I'm serious. We're counting down like they do on MSNBC before a debate. I mean,
no, I think that that's not the case. I think that the American public is now broadly convinced that climate change is happening, that the climate is getting warmer, and also that people are causing it. There's a very broad consensus in the American public now and among our leaders. What there isn't a consensus is the urgency of the matter. So most Americans don't see it as an urgent problem. They see other issues as being more compelling, like education, jobs, war.
Because the healthcare. Impact is tomorrow.
The impact is tomorrow. And what people have to realize is that climate change is a huge issue, and it has very destructive implications for American society, American agriculture, American coastal cities, and that it's something that we really need to take action on. And we can take action on it. There really are things that we can do about it. So both American society and global society needs to start reducing its production of greenhouse gases. So this is something that we can do both in the United States and globally, and we haven't been taking it seriously. So a lot of our leaders give lip service to the idea of reducing greenhouse gases. But certainly in the United States, this is not being done. There's a greater emphasis on jobs and economic activity and lower energy costs, particularly with natural gas. And so we really need to, as citizens and as a society, we really need to start reducing our greenhouse gases. And if we do it now, then the warming which is predicted to come will be much slower And we'll have more time to actually deal with the problem.
We're talking with BU biologist Richard Primack, who's been studying Walden Pond and the different dates and much earlier dates in many cases that flowers are blooming in the year because of the weather's getting warmer. You know, people always say this, that those who are skeptical about climate change say, well, even if the United States does something, you know, other countries like China aren't going to do anything. So what about that, that we have to do this as one world or it's not really going to matter?
Well, we need to really take this up at several levels. So just as individuals, like Thoreau did as an individual of Living Simply, you know, we need to have individual responsibility. We need to have responsibility at local levels, yeah, like at towns and cities and states. But we also need both national and international cooperation. So countries like China right now, which are which is the leading emitter of greenhouse gases, China is also getting involved in these climate change issues. But they're taking it from a slightly different perspective, which is the perspective of air pollution. So they have terrible air pollution in China, and they need to really start reducing their level of pollution just because their own immediate environment is becoming so damaged.
Now, let me ask you something on a practical level, individual citizens, because I think about this, you know, my own life, and you know much more about this than I do. You have the coffee cup debate, you know. The Brookline has cracked down on the styrofoam cups at Dunkin' Donuts, so we have to have paper cups now, and Starbucks has the paper cups, but they've got the plastic lining. So if you're having a debate where you're going to get your coffee, I mean, if you're not going to bring your own kind of mug, what is the styrofoam versus paper cups, plastic bags versus the paper bags? What's a citizen to do?
Well, I think that these issues are important because they make people conscious of it.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at really what is driving energy use in the United States, a lot of it is really how people are heating their homes or cooling their homes, and what kinds of cars people are driving, and how far they're driving their cars. So these are really the places where people can make the greatest difference. I mean, I think that these issues of plastic bags versus paper bags are interesting topics, but the real energy is being consumed in the home,
okay,
and in vehicles.
So I shouldn't worry that much about the plastic versus paper.
Maybe not.
Okay.
I think you should. Now, Richard Primack, a couple of final things from me. One thing we skipped, by the way, you're talking about some of these first blooms were happening earlier. Mm-hmm. What we didn't get into is you also discovered that a huge number of species of plants which Thoreau had cataloged don't even exist anymore. Is that a result of the heating of the environment over the last 150 years, or is there something else going on?
Well, there are really a lot of things which are causing species in Concord to decline in abundance and even disappear locally. So they're locally extinct. They're still present elsewhere in,
yeah,
Massachusetts. So there's a lot of things like deer populations are increasing. They're eating the wildflowers. You have habitats that have been destroyed through suburban development and construction of buildings. There are a lot of invasive species, air pollution, water pollution. But we also think that climate change is one of the factors there. We have a variety of different bits of evidence. But one is that a lot of the warm-loving southern species are increasing in abundance in Concord, and a lot of the more northern species, which are cold-loving, are declining in abundance. So this suggests to us that climate change is at least partially responsible for it.
You know, Doris Kearns Goodwin was in here, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. One of the things we asked her was, do you feel like you know Lincoln? I mean, do you feel like Lincoln is a contemporary in some ways? Maybe that's the wrong choice of words, but you actually know him, not know about him. And she said, without missing a beat, she said, yes, I absolutely do. Do you feel that way about Thoreau? You've had a smile on your face, even though we're talking about something that's a really difficult problem that I know you care about deeply. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because the excitement you feel about his work and yours and him. Is that a fair?
Well, I think that people who study Thoreau really strongly identify with him because Thoreau wrote on so many topics. He had such insight. And I think if you read him, you can start identifying with a lot of the things that he said. And I started to identify very strongly with him because not only was I walking in his footsteps for the last
literally
13 years in Concord, and I sometimes imagined that I was kind of walking along the trails with him. I also went and spent a sabbatical in Japan where I actually did a lot of the writing for this book. And I lived in a tiny apartment that was 8 feet by 14 feet for 3 months, very simply. And while I was living in this apartment, I just imagined that it was like Thoreau's cabin in the woods. So even though I was living in the middle of Tokyo in this apartment, in a big apartment complex, I mean, it felt like the size and it had a lot of the characteristics of his cabin.
That's great.
You know that line, you know, I was reminded of this line. You've seen these in the T-shirts all the time that people have Up and Conquer the Tourists, mm-hmm. one of Thoreau's best-known sayings, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. That's right. One of the many great ones. Richard Primack, it's been
great.
Great
Thank
fun
you so much.
Talking to you, even though it's been depressing because I'm afraid we're all going to be underwater pretty soon. Maybe Jim and I'll be dead by then. I don't know, but I think it's coming fast.
But
anyway.
You can still use the Styrofoam cup. You've gotten Richard's approval, so you're pretty much
well,
clear.
Well, you can't because uh-huh. your friends will tisk at you if they see you with the Styrofoam cup. Anyway, Richard Primack is a professor of biology at Boston University. His new book is Walden Warming, Climate Change Comes to Thoreau's Woods. You can catch him at the Harvard Bookstore this Friday at 3 o'clock.
In case some of you are confused by Marjorie's cameo appearance today, well, Jim and Marjorie recorded that conversation yesterday. I'm Emily Rooney, and we are currently live and local. And Jared Bowen is going to be here next to talk about the latest on Boston stage and screen. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Remember last winter? Well, here's one good thing that happened. More than 10,000 sustainers earned their very own WGBH production credit. Now, it's your turn. Sustainers break their gifts down into monthly installments that automatically renew. And if you sign on as a sustainer before the first day of summer, you might see or hear your name listed alongside some of the best producers in the country. Get your name on the list at wgbh.org/sustainer.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And Boston Lyric Opera presenting I Puritani, a new production of The Bellini Gem, a passionate affair, political intrigue, and one woman's descent into madness. May 2nd through 11th at the Schubert Theater. You can visit blo.org for tickets. And Think Wednesday. Don't miss Nature, Snow Monkeys at 8 o'clock, Nova, Inside Animal Minds at 9, and Your Inner Fish at 10. It's all part of Think Wednesday, tonight starting at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Emily Rooney is here today. Marjorie Egan, as I said, is communing with Hillary Clinton out there at Simmons. Here with us in Studio 3 for a review of the local art scene is GBH's arts editor, Jared Bowen. He's also host of the TV show Open Studio. Good to see you, Jared.
Good
hey,
to be
Jared.
With you. Emily, I try to escape you. This
I
is
know.
Why I come down to do radio, and here you are.
Jared's been giving me rides to work, too, because I've been on the DL, so
yeah,
it's been very
well,
sweet.
Though, for
I'm
yourself.
Doing much better.
Very
Jim,
little complaint.
I started with Emily 15 years ago. I thought I had risen up to the ranks. You know, I'm actually the arts editor now. I actually have my own show. And what am I doing? I'm still
chauffeuring
serving.
Emily Rooney.
I'm bumped down to her chauffeur.
The Inquisition is about
you
to begin.
So is it too early to talk Oscars? Oh, I mean, no. So it just seems like, you know, the minute those things are over, we start doing it. But anyway, you're going to talk about some movies and plays. I have to admit, I haven't heard of any of these movies, so you're just going to have to take it away.
Well,
and I refuse to do the research to find out.
This, of course, Jim. This is what I deal with.
And how does it end?
Apparently so.
This is why I come down here. Well, this is the time to start paying attention because actually, Silence of the Lambs came out in March, so this is the time where some of the serious movies start to come out and they're ramping up, and including some good ones.
I was serious when I said Oscars. Are we going to have some Oscars?
No, absolutely. I don't think we've seen anything yet. Necessarily, except for, well, I can't quite talk about it yet, but this new documentary called Fed Up that's coming up about food. It's coming up in early May. Pay attention to it. We'll be talking more about it. That'll be a shoe-in for best documentary, probably. But anyway, The Railway Man, this is one. It's a very, very interesting film, and you're probably familiar with The Bridge on the River Kwai, that classic film, the 19th.
Big Academy Award winner,
exactly.
Was it not? Yeah.
Exactly.
I remember going
course,
to see it in New York City. Yeah.
Right, and all about British officers in labor camps operated by the Japanese. Well, this is a true story of Eric Lomax, who is one of these British soldiers who was taken prisoner, a prisoner of war during World War II, and just put in the most horrific conditions. He's played by Colin Firth, and you the film opens, you see the legacy of this abuse and what it's done to him. He gets married to Nicole Kidman, and suddenly the marriage sort of goes off the tracks because he's got post-traumatic stress disorder, essentially, and he can't quite deal with his life, and he's carrying all of this stress and all of these burdens around. And to her credit, and again, this is a true story, it actually happened, she pushes him to really dive back into his past and come to terms with what happened to him. So the movie's told in the present and then in flashbacks in just the most astonishing way. You see the extent of this abuse that happens here, and we have a clip with Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman.
He's a wonderful man. I've seen it, but he's a mess. I want to know what happened to Eric. I don't believe in this code of silence that you have.
War leaves a mark.
have suffered much. But I know you have suffered too. And you mean everything to me. Sometime the hating has to stop.
And so what he means by that is he actually goes back to this camp and finds the man who perpetrated this abuse and who he claimed to be an interpreter at the time, but he was somebody who helped facilitate all of the abuse, and he confronts him. So the movie
who is he abusing?
The Japanese they had the British as prisoners of war.
Oh,
And those are the people that they were abusing. And the movie, where it works best, because it's a little bit uneven, but where it works best is when it forces you to examine your own morality and vengeance. Should he meet violence with violence, especially as you know he's going to confront this guy in person? It's such a compelling story. And I have to say, it's really those flashback scenes which are most effective.
I don't want to examine my own morality, but I'm interested anyway. Putting that aside, is Nicole Kidman disappeared for almost a generation? If I recall, wasn't she one of the two or three
It Girl
coming huge stars, not only great looking, but wildly talented? And hasn't she semi-fallen off the face of the earth?
She and Renee Zellweger.
Well, I think Renee Zellweger definitely has. When's the last time that she's done a movie that you can remember?
But am I wrong about Kidman or no?
I think she's been doing smaller roles. She's been out there, but no, probably not as prominently. And I think everybody has their time in the light, and I think you can only withstand it so much. And so I think she's been very choosy about these products. But
how's she in this?
She's okay. It's really a nothing role. That's the unfortunate part, and that's why I had sort of a problem with the contemporary part. And again, it's really the flashbacks which are strong. But no, she doesn't have a heavy role. It was kind of a waste, actually.
So let's talk about another movie that Emily's never heard of.
Yeah.
This is Only Lovers Left Alive. What's the deal with this one?
Well, Emily can be excused because it comes out Friday, so you're getting a preview.
Fine. Thank goodness I didn't say
you
I
acted
saw
like
it
you knew. You liar, liar.
Well, this is Jim Jarmusch doing a vampire movie, and it's with Emily. I know you like her, Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, I love
her.
She
is fabulous.
And
I do too. I
spooky.
Love her.
She's spooky.
And you'll love one of the first scenes in this movie is she plays this vampire who's been alive for hundreds and hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, and she's walking through the streets of Tangier, and she's got the scarf all wrapped around her face. Just watching her walk through this Middle Eastern country with the light in the darkness, her just only watching her eyes because the scarf is covering the rest of her face. She's so mesmerizing. I think there's nothing that this woman can't do wrong because she's so captivating on screen, no matter what she does. And as a vampire, it's just delicious. So she plays this vampire, and she wants to reunite with her lover who lives away all the way across the world in Detroit, and he's played by Tom Hiddleston. They've been married since 1868.
Cute.
And so this is, you're looking at a marriage, lovers who've been alive forever, and they're just weary with each other at this point and weary with the world. She calls him the suicidally romantic scoundrel. So this is what you're diving into. But most of the film takes place in Detroit, which is its own great character. And the way they depict that city and how that city has declined in the architecture and the civilization.
Is it current?
It's current, yeah. It's set in present day, and most of it was actually shot in Detroit.
Is this a vampire movie for those who are not crazy about vampire movies? That's sort of what it sounds like.
It's like an art house vampire movie. Yeah. So it's definitely one to see. Emily, no, I'm not saying to skip, but I think it's as you watch them come together and sort of digest the world because they know so much more, it's very compelling.
All right. Now, the next one, I know you found compelling.
Is it too early for me to go back upstairs?
Yeah, actually, it is. But by the way, is this first play we're going to discuss, the one you said in the news meeting yesterday was one of the best you've seen in ages?
Shape She Makes.
The Shape She Makes is the best show that I've seen this theater season.
Really?
It is.
Yep. And so fill in the blanks.
So The Shape She Makes, you first of all, you go into, it's playing at the ART just through this weekend. Unfortunately, I just learned that it's sold out, but they have some day of tickets available. And it's playing in their smaller Oberon space. You go in, you sit down, and suddenly the play takes place from the audience as the cast members spring from the audience onto the stage before you. So you're already part of this experience. And essentially what you're watching is the legacy of a separation and a divorce and what it does to this 11-year-old girl. But there are no trappings of theater. There are no elaborate costumes. There's no staging. There are some projections. But you see through movement and some dialogue all of the emotions that come to bear for somebody who, first of all, as you're watching the parents fall in love and then breaking up, and then the girl dealing with her parents breaking up and how that follows her into life. And you actually literally physically see it follow her into life. For instance, she goes into a job interview and one of the cast members is wrapped around her leg and she's dragging this cast member along with her, implying this is everything. This is the baggage that she's carrying around with her. In the most emotional way, it gets at everything you feel in life between love and loss and heartbreak.
Tell them about the refrigerator scene.
There's this heartbreaking scene where the woman, as an adult, and she's heavy and she's dressed in gray, and just this actress's face is phenomenal because she's just it's just so sad. And she goes to the refrigerator to take a bite. She closes the refrigerator door, and it's really, again, this is all actors inhabiting the furniture. And the door swings back open, and suddenly you see the food being forced down her throat because she's overeating to compensate for everything she's been through. And that is just horrible because you feel her pain. You just want to leap up from your seat and go hug her. And, I mean, the fact that theater can do this without, as I mentioned, all the trappings in the most basic and fundamental way is why I love this piece.
Yeah, the visuals were striking. Jared brought a few on last night in Greater Boston.
Now, you said it's leaving town this weekend?
It is,
yeah. Where does something like this go?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know.
I didn't mean something like this in a pejorative way, no. But it doesn't sound like it's a Broadway thing, is it, or is it?
No, I don't know what will happen with it here. Hopefully it'll have a life, because I know my colleagues have all really, really loved it as well. And this was something that the ART brought in. It has been in gestation for a couple of years, from what I understand, but this is the first production. So I hope that it'll have a great life all over the place. And by the way, just before we started talking, we were talking about The Americans on FX, and one of the lead characters in that play, Susan Meisner, in that show, is also one of the creators and one of the actors who stars in this production.
Hmm. You know, you said at the beginning of this, Jared Bowen, that the play springs from the audience. And when did that phenomenon start? I remember going to plays 15 years ago, both musicals and dramas were very traditional, good, bad, whatever, very traditional. A few months ago, I saw Rent in New York City.
Really?
And you may know, before you go, I love the movie, wasn't so crazy about the play. not Rent, I'm sorry, Once. I also saw Rent on Broadway a few years ago. But when I saw Once, the show starts, the scene is a bar, essentially a bar in Dublin. And before the show starts, the audience is invited to walk up on the stage and have a drink, literally have a drink. When did this phenomenon start where the level of involvement, it used to be an aberration, occasionally it would happen. When did it start that this is such a critical part of so many stage productions?
Well, I think that people have always played with it. I first, as somebody who came a little bit later to theater, I first became aware of it with The Lion King.
The Lion King, I was going to say that.
Yeah, because I think we were together when it opened the Opera House, and you're sitting there, you're facing the proscenium, and then all of a sudden you hear the gasps and you turn and the animals are marching down the aisles. But I also know that with Diane Paulus, the artistic director of the ART, it's been her theory and mantra to really make the audience part of the show, and not that cheesy, immersive, you know, get me out of here type thing, which I don't necessarily like, but to make the audience be part of the community. And she did it with Hair. She was one. She brought in the Donkey Show for Hair. Even before she came to the ART, she had everybody come up on stage to dance afterward.
I'm very brief aside, since you mentioned Hair. I can't think. Shel Silverstein did a play that was in the East Village when I lived in New York City many, many years ago. And in the wake of Hair, everybody was trying to do plays where people were naked or partially naked. All the actors were naked for most of the play in the East Village. And in terms of the audience, all I can recall, when the play was over, before you were dismissed, all of the actors came into the audience and greeted the audience on their way out. Look at the lack. You're in horror. Yeah. Jared is smiling. And that was the first experience I ever had, actually, with this interaction.
Nice.
And it was
quite an impression on you.
No, it was actually totally uncomfortable, I should say, even though Jared is smiling and apparently could handle it far better than I.
Well, Abramovich, the great performance artist who's just had a documentary made about her, she had a retrospective of MoMA a couple of years ago. And part of the exhibition, to pass from one gallery into the next, you had to pass in between two naked individuals.
Oh, I remember that.
I think it switched between men and men, men and women. And I was one who was smiling here, but I cheated and I went around the other way because I didn't want to pass through them.
Glad to hear it. Okay.
All right, what else?
Jared, The Wholehearted.
Well, I just saw this last night. We're in such this great time of perfect time of great theater here in Boston, because this is very different too. This is presented by Arts Emerson. It's also only here just through this weekend. And this is a story of Dee Crosby, and it's a one-woman show, and you walk in, you see this boxing ring set up, and it's littered with a Jim Beam bottle and pills and other accoutrements of somebody who's been living there in the ring, and you come to understand that she's just had this horrible situation with her husband in which he abused her, but was released on time served and is now in her home that was purchased with all of her winning money, and she's left here trying to pick up her life. But she's a boxer, so she tells a story about this abuse, but also recounting some of the fights that got her to where she is. And all the while, this actress is recounting the boxing through an actual match. She's moving around the stage, and she's also talking into a camera. So it's because she's ultimately sending this love letter through video to a younger woman lover who she's trying to bring back into her life. So it has all of these different elements, but you see her there on stage, you see her up on the screen, and it's quite a fascinating piece in terms of all of these elements that are brought together, and what an unusual story, this female boxer.
And the best part of it, it was only an hour.
Obviously a huge stage fan, Emily Rooney.
I have limited patience.
You know, speaking of fighters, there have been some of the great dramatic movies ever made have been about fighters. Some of the true greats. You've actually seen some of them, Emily. Trust me, you have.
I'm sure I have.
Has that been the same on the stage through the years? Have there been great moments? Are there other dramatic examples of this in recent years, last 10 years?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned it, because right now Rocky is on stage.
I didn't know that.
I believe it's a musical version of Rocky on stage in New York.
Really?
I haven't seen it yet, but there's been a lot of anticipation about it. Sylvester Stallone, I think, was involved to
really?
Some degree, but it's in the hands of very, very capable people. But you think about it, why wouldn't it be perfect for the stage?
Perfect.
Because fighters, the character and constitution and
great
background
music.
Of fighters,
yeah.
they're normally not coming from the 1%, so they're coming from, you know, really diverse...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Complicated and layered backgrounds. It makes a great story no matter what the venue.
Okay, Our Lady, also on the stage here in Boston. What's the deal there?
Well, this is also a one-person show, and this is quite remarkable. I think he's a 24-year-old guy who has done this. He's a former Boston University student who, while he was at BU, his southern father discovered pictures of him in drag, I think on Facebook or something, and severed him from the family and told him he was ashamed to his younger brother, and there was no room for him in the family, cut him off financially, wouldn't support him in school anymore. And what he's done is he's created this play called Our Lady, and he is doing everything, the writing, the design, starring in it in this little space at New Repertory Theater. And it tells a story of coming out and fighting what he calls the monster, everything that assaults you as somebody who's coming out. And he really did this in response to all the gay teen suicides.
So this is his own story?
Yes, it is.
Is that what this is?
Remarkable. Tell him the thing about his father.
Yeah, this is very, very poignant. He it's not completely autobiographical, but there are many autobiographical elements. And at one point he says, "And my father still doesn't accept me. And in every show, I save a seat for him." And then he turns around and gestures to the top row, where there's an empty seat marked for Mr. Fleur, which is his last name.
Man.
Yeah, it's tough stuff, but it's really good theater in the way he's crafted all of it, and he opens it up with this just amalgamation of media reports about gay
suicide.
Teens who've killed themselves. And so right away, everything, the gravity of this issue is brought to bear.
Emily, by the way, told me she was going to go see that when she heard it was 160 minutes.
No.
She figured it was not something.
That one sounds good.
So this is it. You have a huge smile on your face through this discussion today. I mean, in part because Emily's here.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, this is obviously a great season, as you said.
It's a really, really good season. In fact, I'm part of the Theater Critics Association that hands out the Elliot Norton Awards, and we just announced our nominees. And I think we're all so thrilled that the best part of this year is that the nominees are completely across the board. Some years you have one production, one theater racking up everything, but really we saw so much good across everything, big to small, musicals to straight plays. It's a really good time.
And you described them beautifully. Good all to right. see you, Jared.
Okay, Jared Bowen is WGBH Arts Editor and host of Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 on Channel 2. This has been fun, Jim.
It has been fun, even though apparently Jared was a little put off by your presence in this particular setting. No, he wasn't. Emily, it was a joy. Marjorie will return tomorrow. Tomorrow, when Marjorie's back, we're going to talk about global headlines with Charlie Sennett from Global Post and our guy TV Bob Thompson's read on the latest late-night shuffles and some of the great, great new shows. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Emily Rooney. You can watch her tonight at 7 o'clock on Channel 2. I would if I were you. I'll see you tomorrow noon.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye.